Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice has agreed to again testify before the 9/11 Commission, though as she's done in the past, she'll only appear in private and not under oath. The decision reportedly follows pressure from Republicans, concerned that her refusal to take part in this week's public 9/11 hearings made it seem the Bush administration had something to hide. Analysis of this week's politically charged hearings continues, though you could wonder if some commentators watched the same proceedings. So divergent are opinions on the credibility of those who testified, especially former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark. We're joined now by two commentators. Spencer Ackerman is assistant editor for The New Republic. Welcome, Spencer.
Thanks for having me.
And Rich Lowry is editor of The National Review. Welcome, Rich.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Rich Lowry, you call your piece in The National Review Clark's self-immolation. And you're right, if Clark's ever hired by another administration, it should be as dishonesty czar. What struck you most glaringly as Clark's credibility gap?
Well, I don't think you can square the briefing he made in August 2002, which he has stipulated was factual and true because, of course, he would never lie, and his book. The standard for intellectual honesty should be that the facts that were in that briefing and that Clark says were facts should appear in his book in some significant way, and they don't. It's not true, as Clark has said, that Bush did virtually nothing about terrorism prior to 9/11.
So in particular, Rich, you see a credibility gap between Richard Clark's book and his testimony before the 9/11 Commission. Spencer Ackerman, in the matter of credibility gaps, you call your piece in the New Republic credibility gap, but you're not referring to Richard Clark, who you say came off as a devastatingly credible critic of Bush administration policy on terrorism. What's your take on that August 2002 briefing in which Clark sounded like he was very much on board with the Bush approach to terrorism?
Well, I thought he did quite a good job of squaring the circle by pointing the credibility question right back at the Bush administration. And what he emphasized in his hearing again and again is, I was an employee of the Bush administration. You give the spin that they want you to give because the White House needed a line to be put out there for its political interests.
Well, between the two of you, we can see how divergent the views of the same 9/11 hearings are, depending on what perhaps lens you were seeing it through. But I want to ask you both, how politically important was this? A new Pew Research Center poll indicates 42% of Americans heard a lot about Clark's criticism of the president. Only 10% of Americans hadn't heard about his testimony. Spencer Ackerman, how does this cut politically?
It goes right to the heart of the Bush administration's primary political asset, which is that the public, I think the last poll that I saw, gives Bush over Kerry a 21-point advantage on dealing with terrorism. And that comes from the trust and the goodwill that he earned after 9/11 by appearing to act decisively and in a manner prepared to unify the country to face a mortal threat that endangers the lives of all of us. And what Clark is saying undercuts that tremendously. And so the stakes for the White House couldn't be higher.
Rich Lowry, the stakes for the White House and for John Kerry are all about that 10 to 15% of swing voters who haven't made up their minds yet. Any minds made up, you think, by these hearings?
Well, I think there are two things going on, two levels here. One, in the short-term tactical sense, this has been a terrible week for the Bush campaign. They had been making significant progress the last week or two prior to this, and as the phrase goes, defining Kerry on their terms. And this really pushed that effort into the back pages or maybe out of the newspapers altogether. Now, what will people conclude from this? I think most people will probably conclude, and I don't think this is an unreasonable conclusion, although I would disagree with it somewhat myself, that both the Clinton and the Bush administration didn't do enough about terrorism prior to 9/11. And the important question in the election will be, you know, what do we do now? Does the Bush strategy now make sense?
Was the Bush administration hurt by Condoleezza Rice's decision or her chief executive's decision not to testify publicly?
I think that decision on the merits is defensible. They do have a good separation of
executive privilege.
Do have a good separation of powers case. But politically, it plays terribly. I mean, just the way our political culture works, openness is always wins over anything else. And there's also been a kitchen sink aspect to their case against Richard Clark that hasn't been particularly helpful. And there have been some cheap shots. I mean, blaming Clark for what happened in the 1990s and counterterrorism policy, I think it is real low blow, because give him credit. In the Clinton administration, he was leaning forward. He was advocating these more aggressive options, and he was ignored. But you can't blame him for the failures at the top level of the Clinton administration.
Spencer Ackerman, any thoughts on what Rich just said?
A couple things. One, I don't think that Clark really skirts over that. There are a lot of four-letter expletives in his book, particularly after the Cole bombing, about aspects of the Clinton national security apparatus not getting it in the way he does. And secondly, and this plays right into what Rich said, which I totally agree with, the right question is, what do we do now? How do we best protect America against the threat of terrorism? How do we destroy al-Qaeda? How do we destroy affiliated networks? Which is that Clark is saying very directly that the war in Iraq undermines the war on terrorism, and that's got to be at the center of the debate coming into the fall.
You know, Rich Lowry, sifting through this dense testimony will be difficult for many Americans, but one moment will be remembered, and it was kind of clear as a bell, Richard Clark's apology to relatives of people who lost relatives on 9/11. The relatives expressed seemingly universal gratitude for Clark's statement and then walked out to protest the non-appearance of National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. How does that cut politically down the months, do you think?
Well, I think the apology played very well because it's just so rare in Washington. And the fact is that we don't have a culture of responsibility in Washington. And something we've been very critical about the Bush administration for is no one was really fired after 9/11. I mean, George Tenet should have been fired or resigned the next day, I would think, just almost as a matter of principle, because by definition, it was an enormous failure.
Just to finish up, was there any sense what the final conclusion of this commission will be, which way it will fall from what we heard this week?
I think ultimately what's going to come out is that there is a very large failure across the government, across several administrations, across several agencies, and across several officials. But I don't think it's going to focus too much on laying blame at the feet of one administration or one political party.
Rich Lowry, your thoughts on the final commission report in July?
There's a lot of blame to go around, and it's not just Clinton or Bush. It's the media. It's all of us. We didn't pay enough attention to this threat. I think we were all caught up in the dream of the 1990s, which is that a new era of peace and prosperity forever had dawned, and we didn't realize that this threat was as serious as it was.
If I can just add, I'd say Rich is 100% right on that.
Rich Lowry is editor of the National Review. Rich Lowry, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Spencer Ackerman is assistant editor of the New Republic. Spencer, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Gas prices are at record highs. The American Automobile Association puts the average price of a gallon of self-serve regular at almost $1.75 today. Taking inflation into account, it's not the most we've ever paid. That was in 1981. But it is expensive and rising. The question is, why? Philip Berlinger is an economist and a visiting fellow at the Institute for International Economics in Washington. He joins us from his home in California. Dr. Berlinger, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Why is gas so expensive?
Well, the first reason is Saudi Arabia and the other members of OPEC. OPEC has engaged in a serious effort to raise oil prices above the competitive level for the last 4 years, and they succeeded. Their efforts alone have added 30 cents a gallon to the price of gasoline.
Well, how is U.S. policy impacting the price of gas?
Well, the U.S. policy is actually right now working with OPEC because we have been steadily adding oil to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And this began in November 2001 following the terrorist attacks, and it's just continued unrelentedly since. The United States probably should stop putting oil into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We have plenty. We've never used it. And our actions have added half the 30 cents a gallon that I attribute to OPEC. Had we not done it, crude prices would be lower.
Now explain further, why is that? Why does adding to the reserves here drive the price of gas up?
Well, what happens is that oil that otherwise would be sold on the open market and go into inventories, it goes into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It's just taken out of the market. Mm-hmm. So the government's competing with you and with me at the gasoline stations. It's as if our Secretary of Energy drove up in a big SUV right next to your car and started filling out of the same pump. And you take supply out and price goes up.
So you're saying that if the U.S. Put some of this oil back into production, there'd obviously be more oil and it would drive the cost down. But there are others who are saying that there's another thing that happens when the U.S. buys so much oil at this higher price to put into the reserves, that it's driving up speculation about oil because other countries feel that maybe the U.S. is concerned about a terrorist attack.
Well, there is a great deal of speculation in the world oil market today, and that's pushing prices up. But it's not related to terrorism. All commodity prices, copper, scrap metal, oil, are being pushed up, one, by strong demand from China, which has a rapidly growing economy, and two, by hedge funds, hot money from wealthy investors that are looking for high returns. And they're essentially betting on OPEC right now, so they're bidding prices up as well.
The president has called on Congress to pass his energy bill. It's got a lot of tax breaks for oil exploration and production. Would that help?
No.
Because?
The energy bill would do nothing. The key to a good energy bill is conservation, and there's nothing in there. One reason that we neglect for the high gasoline prices is our insistence on driving SUVs and cars that get very few miles to the gallon. There's nothing in this bill that encourages Americans to switch to more efficient vehicles. And really, until we switch to more efficient vehicles, gasoline prices will keep going up.
So in your opinion, you're saying that's the only thing that will drive prices down, that Americans conserve more?
Yes. Now, that doesn't mean prices today shouldn't be lower. But the fact of the matter is, long-term, and what the president talks about is energy bill doing something good for the consumer, the only way that we're going to bring gasoline prices down is to conserve. Mm. And there's nothing in this bill that does that. It's just empty.
Well, let's look ahead. Gas prices normally rise in the summer as people drive more and as refineries change over from winter to summer fuel. How high could it go?
History suggests we're at or near the peak. What happens is we get the high prices when we change over. Prices then fall until August, when prices will jump again. This year we may see high prices remain from April all the way through the summer, and prices could go 20% higher. We could see $2 gasoline on average across the country. I don't think that's likely, but this is the first time we're getting towards that point.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Verliger, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was good talking to you.
Dr. Philip Verliger is an economist and a visiting fellow at the Institute for International Economics in Washington. He spoke to us from his home in California.
Just ahead, we speak to a neighbor of the 16-year-old West Bank boy who was sent on a suicide mission.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's here and now.
Connecticut's Governor John Rowland has declared a state of emergency after a fiery tanker truck crash melted a bridge and shut down a mile-long stretch of I-95, the main route between New York and Boston, and one of the busiest thoroughfares in the nation's highway system. We're joined by Jerry Griswold. She's Director of Operations for Metro Networks in Hartford. Jerry, how bad is it there?
It's pretty bad, Robin. Obviously, as you can imagine, I mean, in terms of the impact that it is going to make on interstate commerce, it's really, really bad. But it was a very curious morning drive that we had this morning, in that word got out that there was a major disaster, and people actually stayed away from the area. Mm. But my heart really bleeds, especially for the truck drivers who have nowhere to go but, you know, some secondary roadways, and they were incredibly congested. And we definitely had other road closures in the state that were triggered by truck traffic.
120,000 vehicles pass along this route. It's expected to be closed for a couple of weeks. What's going to happen? Are trucks going to have to be allowed on some of the roads that normally don't allow them?
I am strictly venturing a guess. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine that the Merritt Parkway, which does not allow truck traffic normally, will definitely be taking truck traffic. But because of the overpasses, I'm only guessing that they will take some extra traffic, commercial traffic, but certainly not tractor-trailer traffic.
Right. And, Jerry, for those of our listeners who aren't in this area, this is one of those roads that is a nightmare anyway.
Mm-hmm. Every single day. It is just bumper to bumper from the beginning of morning rush hour until the end, and then in the afternoons as well. And as I said, Fridays are normally kind of quiet. We have this afternoon drive to get through, and the proof will be in the pudding there in terms of how crucial. And I can only imagine this is going to cause great agita for people for 10 to 14 days.
Jerry Griswold of Metro Networks in Hartford, Connecticut. Today's tie-up was caused by a tanker accident, but security experts are worried about terrorism. Next week, we'll look at security and the nation's roads.
A Palestinian schoolboy surrendered at an Israeli checkpoint this week, aborting a suicide bombing mission. The boy, Hussam Abdu, was recruited by an as-yet-unidentified extremist group. He'd strapped a belt of explosives under his sweater. The group promised him they would send his mother money, $23 to be exact. The teenager is now in Israeli custody. His family and many Palestinians have openly condemned the manipulation of the boy by those seeking to bomb Israelis. Hussam Abdu's parents don't speak English, and so they asked a neighbor, Hilmi Laham, to speak to us earlier today. Mr. Laham, where is Hussam Abdu now?
I think he is in the checkpoint of the Huwara camp now. The Israelis.
Held by the Israelis still.
Yeah.
What do people think will happen to him? Will he go to trial for this?
Up to now, nobody knows. It depends on news from the camp now.
What kind of boy is Hussam Abdu?
Yeah, he's a good boy. So he's like his age. Everyone, what do you think about 15 years or 16 years? What you will expect from him? He's a good boy. He is in good manners. So he is good in his school, but he has some small problems in the last days. Nothing else. He is very normal, very, very normal.
Now, Mr. Laham, how do Palestinians feel about someone so young being asked to be a suicide bomber?
Nobody agree for this age to do these operations, you know, because still in the first life, first days in his life. So it's strange to be that.
Can I ask you whether you feel that suicide bombers who are older is a legitimate way to fight the Israelis?
You know, we don't agree about this manner of taking rights from the others. But this is the only thing Palestinians have in their hands. Everyone, you can ask him about his opinion. He will say, I refuse this manner, but nothing in hands.
Palestinians feel powerless without the possibility of suicide bombers? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying everybody here in Palestine refuses that manner of taking rights from your enemy. But Palestinians also don't have anything to do. They don't have weapons. They don't have anything. They do have their bodies only. This is the opinion, public opinion in Palestine. Even if it is not good way.
Now, are people angry at the resistance groups who caused the boy to do this?
You see, up to now, nobody from this group said that this operation belonged to me. So it's now a mysterious case. We don't know about it. And, nothing we do now.
Nobody wants to take credit for it.
Up to now, yes.
Mr. Laham, tell me about the boy's family. What are they doing? How are they feeling?
They feel very, very sad now, and they are very angry because they are nothing to know about him now, what he is going to do, what's becoming in the future, nothing. They can't eat well, they can't sleep well, they can't talk to people well. So, as you know, this is feelings, human feelings.
How do you think Palestinians should protest when they oppose something Israel does?
We don't have another manner to protest. This is fighting just we have in hands now. We also in the past, we depended on America, on Europeans, on everybody, but everybody is staying, looking, watching without taking any activities.
Mr. Laham, how do you think peace can be made between Israelis and Palestinians?
Ask the politicians. By talkings. By talkings. This is the only way, the best way. You can ask the politicals. They know better than me.
Mr. Laham, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
We've been speaking to Hilmi Laham. He's a neighbor of Hussam Abdu. We spoke to Mr. Laham at the Abdu home.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Think back to some of these images of 2003. Before he was found in a spider hole, Saddam Hussein's picture was posted on the side of a milk carton. Michael Jackson was dangled from a hotel balcony by police authorities. The Columbia space shuttle didn't explode. It flew into the huge hands of God. The images are from the editorial pages of the nation's newspapers in the space reserved for cartoonists. These and many other cartoons are included in a new book called The Best Editorial Cartoons 2004 Edition. It was compiled by Charles Brooks with help from James Calhoun of Pelican Publishing. James has been looking at editorial cartoons for 32 years now, and he joins us on the line from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. James, welcome.
Thank you. How are you today?
I'm just fine. What a wonderful book. What a wonderful retrospective. One of my favorites of the editorial cartoons is one that I just mentioned, an image of the Columbia space shuttle flying into these huge, huge sketched hands, obviously of God. So the cartoons can be both poignant and lacerating.
That's right, and either one can command a great deal of attention. That's one reason editorial cartoons are still popular. Wherever you have a newspaper, you're probably going to have editorial cartoons because they have a message that people can quickly grasp and understand.
Yeah, and your book is divided into several of the news sections. We've got Iraq, the economy, the media come to mind. Let's take a look. Let's start with one of the biggest news events of the year, the war in Iraq. What's your favorite?
Well, you see the cover, a picture of this year's 2004 edition by Bob Ariel of the South Carolina State. You see Saddam Hussein, a statue of him, being dumped unceremoniously from a dump truck into what obviously is the trash heap of history with Lenin and Stalin and other people already there.
I remember that one. By the way, we're going to put some of these pictures on our website so people can follow along at home if you'd like. I also like the one that won the 2003 Pulitzer Prize. He's got overalls on and a holding a shotgun. He's got a big USA on his coveralls. He says, "Ma, I was out standing guard, watching for foreign evildoers hell-bent on attacking our homeland when a gall-dang corporate CEO snuck up and snatched my wallet."
That's by David Horsey of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, probably one of the 10 best cartoonists in the country. I might refer you to also two award-winning cartoons from last year on page 8 and 9.
Mm-hmm.
You have George Bush, two views of George Bush.
Right.
Now, You can often tell a cartoonist's political views by how he caricatures a particular individual. In this case, on the left, you see George Bush, Big Ears, Big Mouth, by Stephen Sack. Mike Thompson of the Detroit Free Press on the facing page has chosen to emphasize and exaggerate the ears of George Bush. If you look in cartoons around the country, the ears will generally tell you whether the cartoonist is a supporter of George Bush or a detractor of George Bush.
Well, isn't that something? They are huge. They are big flapping ears. There you
I
see
just
them.
Saw a cartoon yesterday of George Bush with enormous ears, like bigger than your typical burro or donkey.
And that tells you that
And the cartoon was very unfavorable.
Well, yeah, that would be that way. Well, politics has a huge section in the book as well. What's your favorite of the political cartoons?
Let's look at the Democrat section.
Mm-hmm.
You see George Bush in a flight suit.
I was going to mention this one. Go ahead.
Anytime you see George Bush in a flight suit, probably the cartoonist is making a pretty strong message. But in this case, George Bush comes off a little better than the fellow in the opposite panel, Bill Clinton.
Because his pants are down and he's got boxers on with big red hearts on them, and the caption says, which suit most offends Democrats?
Pretty good point. But even though he's in the flight suit in that picture, he comes off fairly well.
Better than the panel next to him. Well, then there's just the various news events of the year that were documented. Everybody from Rush Limbaugh to, well, of course, the Catholic Church, sports.
There are a lot of subjects covered here, but one of them we always cover is in memoriam. Public figures who have died during the year, and they're treated in various ways by various cartoonists. Page 193.
I'm right there.
Example,
yep.
Gregory Peck, everybody's favorite, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Every cartoonist that I saw was very favorable to Gregory Peck.
There are a couple of Gregory Peck frames. In one, he's walking, looking just like Atticus from To Kill a Mockingbird. He's got his jacket slung over his shoulder and his briefcase, and above it, the caption reads, Miss Jean Louise, stand up, your father's passing.
That's right.
Below it, there's a man and his son watching television, seeing the news of Gregory Peck's death. The boy says, did his movies ever have special effects? The father says, very special, class, decency, integrity.
That's a very strong message saying Gregory Peck was someone very special in American culture.
In the next page, Johnny Cash. There's two panels. One, there's a row of angels all in white. There's one angel dressed in black.
That's right, a man in black surrounded by angels.
And from the cloud above comes the caption, Johnny, about the outfit. Mr. Rogers gets a couple. Bob Hope is at the gates of heaven with his golf clubs. He says, I'm here to entertain the troops. And the book closes with the cartoon memorials for Bill Mauldin, who was, of course, the great cartoonist and writer of World War II.
That's right. And that was a fitting close, we felt, to this edition. This book is published annually. For the past 32 years, we try to present the best cartoons of the major events of the year. And signing off with Bill Mauldin in this issue is intended to pay special tribute to him.
Right. Well, you have two soldiers saluting his helmet on a fountain pen staked into the ground.
Sticking in the ground. Bill Mauldin certainly was a grandfather to many of the cartoonists practicing today.
James Calhoun, you've been looking at these cartoons for 32 years. Do you have a favorite, something that jumps out?
One cartoon that sticks in my mind is the cover cartoon on the 2002 edition of this book a couple of years ago, drawn by Mike Lukovich of the Atlanta Constitution. This, of course, was drawn right after 9/11, very traumatic time for America. The cartoon focuses on the face of the Statue of Liberty. Reflected in the eyes of the statue are the Twin Towers, one of them smoking, and an airliner just about to crash into the building.
Mm.
There is not a single word in the cartoon. It is totally visual, and it has, in my mind, about as strong an impact as a cartoon could have. That's my idea of a great cartoon.
The lady watching. Well, James Calhoun, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Editor James Kalloon of Pelican Publishing, he helped compile the book, The Best Editorial Cartoons, 2004 edition. For more information and to look at some of the cartoons we've been talking about, check out our website, here-now.org.
Still to come, we review the new film, Lady Killers, starring Tom Hanks.
You're listening to Here and Now. I've kept a tattered magazine article for years. It was written by the now infamous Stephen Glass of the New Republic, and it described a Monica Lewinsky paraphernalia booth at a convention. Well, Stephen Glass was found to have fabricated all or part of 27 articles for the New Republic. The movie about his life, Shattered Glass, is now out on DVD. Charles Lane is the former editor of the New Republic who eventually investigated Glass and found the truth about the Monica Lewinsky paraphernalia booth. Hello there.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, it didn't exist.
Yes, that's right.
What happened? I mean, did you have any sense at all as his editor that he might have been making things up?
There were some rumors, and there had been little hints here and there, but I never was aware in any conscious way that he was a fake until we were, you know, kind of alerted to a problem with one story by some journalists from Forbes, and I started to investigate, and then it very quickly became evident that he'd been faking a lot of things.
And which story was that?
This was a story called Hack Heaven. It ran in the May 18th, 1998 New Republic, and it was ostensibly a story about a teenage hacker who'd extorted money from a software company. It went in to the magazine. It had been fact-checked and everything, and when I looked into it further, it turned out absolutely not a word of it was true.
And people would say, how could that happen if it was fact-checked? I mean, wouldn't you, in the Monica Lewinsky case, call the convention and see if they had a booth that sold Monica Lewinsky's berets? Or how does it happen?
Well, I don't think the New Republic's fact-checking was as thorough as it should have been, but I also think that people shouldn't overestimate how much time and money the New Republic at that time had to devote to fact-checking. There was a very small number of people, sometimes only two people a week, fact-checking the entire magazine, and they were all overloaded. And Steve was a friend and trusted, and he was there all the time, and he had been a fact-checker himself, and he knew how the system worked. And between the combination of lack of resources, trust, and somebody who knew how to beat the system, it all got through.
Could you tick off for us some of the other stories that weren't true, just the headlines?
He wrote a false story about people who worshipped George Bush, the first one who was president. He wrote another false story about young conservatives engaging in all kinds of drug abuse and sexual misbehavior. He wrote a lot of false stories. I don't think you have enough time on the show to go through all of them.
Yeah. And now the subject of his own book and a movie. Does that grate a little bit? Because it's fame. It might be infamous, but it's fame.
Well, I don't think the movie is going to glorify Steve Glass. People who see the movie have uniformly walked out with a negative view of what he did. The book is another story. I mean, he claims it's fiction, but it's clearly a roman à clef. Some of the details in it are derived from experiences that I know about firsthand, and they're basically just transmitted from what really happened. So he's attempting in that book to kind of offer his own combination of mea culpa and a little bit of, some excuses for what he did.
One last question. Your role in all of this, do you feel duped?
Well, I did until I wasn't. You know, I sort of stopped being duped at a certain point, and then I now feel like nothing, I would never, ever believe anything he says again, no matter how trivial. I just feel like there's that old saying, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
Yeah, fool me 27 times.
And shame on, really shame on me.
Yeah. Charles Lane, thank you.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thanks a lot, Robin.
Charles Lane, former editor of the New Republic magazine, now a writer for the Washington Post.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The 1955 black comedy, The Lady Killers, starred Alec Guinness as a professor who shows up on the doorstep of an elderly lady.
Mrs. Wilberforce?
Yes?
I understand you have rooms to let.
Oh, the rooms, yes. Won't you come in, please?
Thank you. My name's Marcus.
How do you do, Mr. Marcus?
Professor Marcus.
Oh, how do you do, Professor? Yes, I have two, right? Yes, would you excuse me a moment while I put this away, please?
But the professor is also a criminal mastermind who plans to use the old lady's house for nefarious purposes. Now The Lady Killers has been remade by brothers Ethan and Joel Coen, known for their own dark comedies, such as Blood Simple and Fargo. The new Lady Killers stars Tom Hanks as the professor.
Allow me to present myself formally. Goldthwaite Higginson Doerr, Ph.D.
Like him?
I beg your pardon, ma'am?
Good.
The new version of The Lady Killers opens today, and joining us in the studio is Here and Now's own Lady Killer, film reviewer Eric Schaefer. Welcome, Eric.
Why, thank you, Bill.
So tell us about The Lady Killers, old and new.
Well, the original movie is a great film. Peter Sellers is in it. Herbert Lom is in it. It's very funny, very droll, and somewhat sinister as well. But the new Lady Killers is just as good. This is one of those situations where a remake is not a mistake. The Coen brothers have reset the film in contemporary America, in Mississippi, and it's a crackerjack movie.
Funny, droll, and sinister. That about describes the life's work of the Coen brothers.
Yeah, and this one fits in really, really well. They've never done a straight remake before. You know, a lot of the Coen brothers movies show influences of other films like The Big Sleep and Yojimbo and so on.
Tom Hanks as a villain.
Tom Hanks as a villain. You know, it's been a while since we've seen Tom Hanks doing comedy, and it's a real pleasure to see him back in a comic role. He shows up at the door of this lovely old widow, and he wants to rent a room so that he and this band of criminals that he have assembled can dig through her basement to the counting house of a riverboat gambling ship. And so in order to do that, they're going to use her basement as sort of a rehearsal place to rehearse Renaissance music, and that will then cover up the sounds of their digging. And in this scene, he's going down to the basement for the very first time to check out the acoustics.
This looks promising.
A little dank, ain't it?
Indeed. That only improves the acoustics.
Or ya?
Marvelous. Yes. Oh, these earthen walls are ideal for baffling the higher registers of the lute or sackbut. That is why so much music of the Cinquecento is played in crypts and catacombs. This is ideal. This is perfect. This is more than perfect. I can scarcely contain my glee.
This role is completely over the top. You know, he's wearing these kind of funny fake teeth, just like Alec Guinness did in the original. He has this sort of very flowery manner of speaking, this, you know, overly courtly manners, and Hanks is just a scream in this movie.
What about some of the other performances, Eric? Irma Hall's the lady of the house and the unwitting victim.
Yeah, and Irma Hall is just a wonderful character. She is somewhat gullible, but she's also very, very feisty.
You know the Fontes boy.
McAtee Fontes?
No, not him. Wee Mac. McAtee's eldest.
Oh, yeah. I believe I do.
Well, he's a good boy now. Mm-hmm. But he done gone down to the Costco in Pascagoula and got himself a blaster.
What?
And he been playing that music.
Well, if you want, you know.
Loud!
Well, I could go talk to him.
Left my wallet in El Segundo.
He left his wallet.
Hippity-hop music. You know, they calls it hippity-hop music, but it don't make me want to go hippity-hop.
The Coen brothers know how to do this Southern stuff. I don't know where they learned it.
I don't know either, but they really got it down pat. Irma Hall is wonderful, and you've got this great cast of other characters as well, the criminals. Sui Ma plays the general, who is this Southeast Asian immigrant who evidently has a very shady past. And you've also got J.K. Simmons, who plays Mr. Pancake. And Mr. Pancake is this character who's an explosive expert who also has the problem of irritable bowel syndrome. And in this scene, we hear him when he's on the set of a dog food commercial trying to get this dog into a World War I gas mask, and things just don't quite work out right.
Mm. The hell is this?
World War I vintage gas mask. It's authentic. Strapped on, of course, so it can't fall off. The animal is free to be as active as he wants. It doesn't inhibit his movement in any way, and I think it really sells the whole doughboy thing.
Yeah, it looks like a joke.
You're absolutely right. The gas mask is a whimsical concept.
How the hell does it eat when it gets to the nibbles ready to eat?
Well, you're absolutely right.
Put the damn canteen back on the dog. That says he's a soldier. Dented tin canteen, right? Strap it to his car.
Easiest thing in the world.
You know, you could almost play that clip and guess that it was a Coen Brothers movie.
Right, right. And Simmons just plays it completely straight throughout, and that's what works so well, is that he's playing it straight.
Well, one thing that's worked well for the Coen Brothers is collaborating with producer T-Bone Burnett on soundtracks, as they did on the Grammy Award-winning Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and on this film.
Right. T-Bone Burnett and Carter Burwell, who writes the incidental music, they do a wonderful job. A lot of the music in the film is gospel music. I'd point out, too, that Roger Deakins is their cinematographer in most instances. He, too, has done a wonderful job in sort of capturing the sort of laid-back, hot summer days in the South. So the movie not only looks good, it sounds good, and it's a laugh riot.
This sounds like a rare enough Eric Schaefer rave.
Well, I raved last week about The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Rightly so.
I'm raving again this week. It's probably rare to hear two raves in a row.
We're on a roll.
It's a lot of fun.
Thanks, Eric.
My pleasure, Bill.
Here in Now Film Reviewer, Eric Schaefer, we've been talking about The Lady Killers, which opens today.
Well, my sister, Lord, I wonder where she's gone, Lord. Well, if she made it in kingdom, Lord, she won't be troubled no
Now this update on The Passion of the Christ. Mel Gibson's blockbuster depiction of the crucifixion of Jesus has earned a record $300 million and is on its way to becoming one of the biggest grossing films of all time. After 3 weeks, The Passion was knocked off its number one perch in the U.S. by the remake of Dawn of the Dead and has now moved overseas, accompanied by the same audience-generating storm of criticism seen in the U.S. In London, the Archbishop of Canterbury joined the leader of England's Catholics and blasted the film, saying it reinforces stereotypes. Even Britain's evangelicals have been critical. The Christian satellite channel Revelation TV is distributing leaflets to filmgoers to emphasize that the death of Jesus was part of God's plan, not something to lay blame on. But despite the critics around the world, several people have reported being born again while watching the movie, and two have died of heart attacks. No word of how many people died watching other movies, but there were probably no other films in the last few weeks that provoked a confession of murder. A Texas man said he wanted to seek redemption after seeing The Passion of the Christ, and so he turned himself in for the murder of his 19-year-old girlfriend who was pregnant with his child. Well, if all of this seems too weighty, there is another film about a Jewish guy from Nazareth who is worshipped and crucified. The Life of Brian, the Monty Python classic about the reluctant Messiah, Brian of Nazareth, born in the manger next door to Jesus, is returning soon to theaters to celebrate its 25th anniversary and, as the filmmakers say, offset the hysteria around Gibson's film. Well, Brian might have some words of advice for Mel Gibson regarding the critics of his movie. As Brian is led to the cross, he comments, "There's just no pleasing some people," to which a beggar replies, "That's just what Jesus said."
Always look on the bright side of life. Always.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.